Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is episode 55, dropping April 2nd for an April 3rd issue of the journal. I am Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods, here with Captain Joints a Lot.
And I do like my joints. Deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, the best field out there. Just saying it.
Her name is Antonia Chen, in case you're wondering, right? We were just here, you know, doing some research. And now it's time to record this episode of Your Cases on Hold. Will the cases go on hold this week? Well, we remains to be seen. That said, this is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. Get in while there's still time to get all of your CME and test prep needs addressed in the best way possible. As always, these opinions and the takes are mine and those of Dr. Chen, and do not reflect the editorial board, the opinion of the editor-in-chief, the other journals, the board of trustees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Without further engagement or digression, let's begin. There's a lot in the pile. There's a lot in top of the pile for this episode. I'll tell you, we've got gender trends and authorship in six major orthopedic journals by Grant, Addressing the Impact of Race and Ethnicity on Musculoskeletal Spine Care in the United States by Ajay. Shouldn't Our Goal in All Capitals Be to Find a Better Way by Barker, Permanently Free. That title's intriguing. And we have Orthopedic Leadership Through the Anti-Racist Lens, Part 1, which addresses critical challenges to academic career development for Black orthopedic surgeons by Carson. And then there's Part 2, which is the Orthopedic Chair's Perspective on Cultivating an Inclusive and Anti-Racist Workforce by Lawrenceing. And we have the AOA Critical Issues, A Culture of Safety Across All Orthopedic Professional Endeavors by Dr. Ring of the University of Texas, Hook'em Horns. And then we have Total Joint Arthroplasty in Patients Who Are Obese or Morbidly Obese, An Ethical Analysis by Dr. LaChance. You thought that was the end of the pile, but wait, there is more.
There's always more.
Like smashed reconstruction of the extensor mechanism, a concise 5-year follow-up of two previous reports by Abdul. And this comes with an infographic. So I feel like that's like a whole issue's worth of articles just in the top of the pile. This is like one of the special edition giant issues of JBJS. So, you know, get your hands on it, get to reading. There's really some great stuff in here and some real important insights, vital information I think everyone will benefit from reading. We're now going to move into the headlines. In the headlines this week, my headline is Surgery for Vertebral Osteomyelitis Lowers 1-Year Mortality and Failure Rates Compared with Non-Surgical Treatment, a Propensity Matched Analysis by Koenig and colleagues. There is a commentary on this, so you don't have to take my word for it. You can see what others in the field are thinking as well. This is an increasingly common problem, unfortunately, for us in the spine space of vertebral osteomyelitis, both due to the aging demographic as a whole, as well as a heightened prevalence of intravenous drug use, which increases the proclivity for these types of conditions. Similar to situations that we've discussed before around spinal metastases, epidural abscess, certain types of fractures in frail patients, you're very concerned in these situations because this can be a life-threatening condition. You want to perform a surgical intervention that is also a high-intensity procedure. There's limited physiologic reserve for these patients. And in a lot of these situations, you kind of have, within the umbrella of the condition itself, you have patients who are probably going to do fairly well based on their physiologic parameters. And then you have patients who are going to do poorly no matter what. And oftentimes, particularly in previous retrospective investigations, those patients in the, they're going to do poorly no matter what, like they wouldn't survive a surgery, so they just got non-operative treatment, for example. That colors the benefit of non-operative treatment. It makes non-operative treatment seem really bad. And that's the definition of a selection bias. So these authors used about 12 years worth of data from their center to look at a cohort of patients who were treated for vertebral osteomyelitis, and they had over 300 patients. The first things that pop out to me is that there's a huge disparity in terms of the treatment selection. So they had 313 patients who had surgery, and then they had 42 patients who had non-operative management. So when about 10% of your cohort is being treated with one thing and everyone else is getting the other thing, that again presents a marker, a flag for me that there's at least what we would call confounding by indication. You know, if you look at their table one, and we want to, you know, dive into this, the percentages and things like that can really be misleading, especially in the non-surgical group, because you're just talking about a percentage of 42 patients. And that can lead to issues with power in terms of detecting statistical differences. But, you know, overall, you're not seeing like major differences, perhaps a lower number of patients with chronic kidney disease in the non-surgical cohort. I mean, like overall, it seems like the surgical cohort is actually the sicker patients to some degree. They wanted to address this using propensity score matching, which of course is a very powerful causal inference technique. It's very hard to do though when you just have a small number of patients. Ostensibly here, they're going to be developing a score around the propensity for non-operative management, which means that maybe the patients who were likely to benefit highly from surgery and they didn't have reservations about how they might survive that procedure are going to be eliminated, and you're going to have a smaller cohort of patients. Ultimately, they only came down to 30 patients in each group, surgical and non-surgical. That's a really small cohort, a very limited power to make determinations on post hoc. And they used a lot of factors: age, sex, body mass index, ASA scores, the level, if they had endocarditis, neurologic deficit. These are a lot of variables to consider, a lot of degrees of freedom in a very small number of cases, which can then also create artifacts in the results. The results are really interesting. This was a study that I spent a lot of time just trying to like think and unpack. Well, you know, what do these analyses mean really? Like what is the signal that we're seeing? And after hours and hours and hours and hours of pondering over this, I still don't feel I have the answer. I have to admit, this study is something of a conundrum for me. So, you know, I will direct you to table four, where they're describing the clinical outcomes. And they looked at mortality at 30 days and 1 year, and then at recurrence, and then at this combination of death or recurrence. I really don't like that combined outcome variable. First of all, death is a competing risk with recurrence. So if the patient passes away, they can't have a recurrence. And, you know, it's hard to operationalize that. Basically, it's like this non-specific adverse outcome, but it could be recurrence, which is not as bad as death, obviously. And, you know, we see that for 30 days, the mortality figures are higher amongst the surgical treated patients. At 30 days in the entire cohort, it's like 6% for the surgical versus 3% for the non-surgical. And then after the matching, it's 4% for the non-surgical and 7% for the surgical. That's not significantly different, only based off of the power. It's a very small number of patients. So obviously 7% is not equal to 4%. And in a larger cohort, if those numbers remain the same, those percentages remain the same, that would be a significant difference. With 1 year mortality, it's 23% for the entire cohort versus 12% non-op to op, and then 25% versus 4% in the propensity score matching. But that also doesn't really make sense because they already had two patients die at 30 days. So how does that just become one patient at 1 year? We have a case of a disappearing patient here. And I don't know if they meant
like a Twilight Zone thing?
I don't know if they meant like one patient died between 30 days and 1 year, in which case it would be three patients. I'm really not sure. The recurrence, similarly, once they did the matching, while it's higher in the non-op treatment, 17% versus 10%, it's not significantly different. And then when they do this composite measure, then they have 43% with an adverse event versus 15% with an adverse event. But when you count the numbers between the recurrence and the one-year mortality, you're still missing that one patient. So there's some unanswered questions here. And the signal is sort of what we would call stochastic, or it's kind of like you can't make sense of it. It's one thing over here and then something over there. There's a lot of moving pieces and parts. And I think some of that, a lot of that really has to do with the limited number of patients that were treated non-operatively. And really, I would say their approach, while from a textbook definition, you know, if you're just talking about it's the appropriate application of propensity score matching, I'm not sure that the sample, I do not think, I'll go a step further even. I don't think that the sample is robust enough for them to really leverage the absolute benefits that you get for propensity score matching. We have another propensity score paper later on in this episode that has thousands and thousands of patients. And that's where you really get the benefit of the propensity score technique. In this piece, I don't think it can really unpack the confounding by indication. I don't think it can do it based on the data that they have available on these patients. The fact that they're trying to cram a whole lot of variables into a small number of actual events when it comes to the non-operative management. And that leads to all sorts of bad things that you don't want in your models, like restricted clinical variation or truncation. So, you know, this is an interesting study because they have a fair number of patients. I think if you're just looking at like using it as a natural history, you know, there are not a lot of papers on this type of issue that have followed this number of patients for as long as they have over a 10-year plus time window, you know, in terms of the catchment time frame. So those are the advantages that I see of this paper. I would put on hold attempts to really use the outcomes as informing clinical care. I would have to caution that pretty significantly.
So on hold or not on hold?
If we're going to take it at face value for what they say that they're doing, I mean, you know, like their conclusions. In our matched cohort of patients with vertebral osteomyelitis, surgical intervention resulted in a significantly lower rate of treatment failure compared with non-surgical intervention. Furthermore, non-surgical treatment was an independent risk factor for treatment failure. I would say that's on hold.
There you have it, boys and girls. You have that one on hold.
All right. So we got one on hold. Are we going to go two for two here? Preoperative bladder scanning can predict postoperative urinary retention following total joint arthroplasty by Magaldi with a visual summary and 30 days free.
So postoperative urinary retention can prevent patients from going home after surgery, especially same-day discharge patients. So this is not a new topic. A lot of studies have been done looking at causes and increased likelihood of developing postoperative urinary retention, also known as POUR, P-O-U-R. But there have been a few studies that looked at preoperative post-void residual volume using bladder ultrasonography. So this study wanted to see if symptom surveys, specifically the American Urological Association Symptom Index, which I didn't know existed, and or bladder scanning can predict postoperative urinary retention. It was a prospective study at a single institution from December 1, 2020 to September 30, 2021. It had 507 patients, more female than male. And exclusion criteria are those who are undergoing non-elective total joint, so fracturcator, those who cannot urinate on their own, patients with pre-existing indwelling catheter or urostomy, and neurologic conditions, which is pretty broad. I guess it's better than some studies that were more restrictive, such as like a history of urinary retention, but bladder symptoms, but it did include neurological symptoms that could predispose to urinary retention. Again, the survey was the American Urological Association, and a higher number was indicative of having more symptoms with regards to urinary problems. This was done preoperatively and at 14 and 64 days postoperatively, along with two questions about UTI. And they did post-void bladder scanners in the preoperative setting. So right before surgery, they'd go to the bathroom and they would scan their bladders about 5 to 10 minutes after voiding. And they would record that number. And that number was exactly what we're saying, was that post-void residual volume. And then postoperatively, they did bladder scans every 4 to 6 hours until the patient was independently voiding. POUR was defined as a bladder volume of greater than 500 that required catheterization because the patient could not void. Now, this is controversial. Some cutoffs start at 300, some cutoffs go to 1,000. In our hospital, it depends on which nurse is there, where they feel comfortable that the patient should be catheterized, should not be catheterized, but they use 500 for the study. And if the bladder volume again exceeded 500 milliliters following the first catheterization, the patient was catheterized again and urology was consulted for a full replacement. almost all patients got spinal anesthesia, 98% of them, and they did chi-square tests, students t-test. They did univariate analysis to see which association of each variable of interest and whether the patient received the catheter after surgery. And then they used these predictive variables to do multivariable analysis. They also looked at residual bladder volumes using a quintile analysis to give some numerical data as to what residual bladder volumes before surgery could be predictive of after surgery poor. They did separate total hips and total knees, and there are different cohorts of patients, even though I know they make fun of us of just doing hips and just doing knees and rights and lefts. But total hip patients, total knee patients can be different with regards to spinal anesthesia, timing and surgery, things like that. So the rate of postoperative urinary retention was 37% in total knee arthroplasty patients. And these preoperative bladder scannings revealed that patients who developed POR retained on average 25 millimeters more of urinary volume than the patients who did not require catheterization. Among the total knee patients, younger age and lower BMI were associated with increased catheterization, and age was not statistically significant. It was just association. So if you want to look at p-values, it's 0.059. That's a whole other discussion about going into p-value hunting, which we're not doing here. No difference.
Well, also, don't report it as a main finding and then be like, oh, it wasn't statistically significant. If it wasn't statistically significant, it's not a main finding.
Wasn't statistically significant. Exactly right. Just the BMI. End of story, right? So it should have gone with the no difference category. So no differences with AUA score, sex, patient reported outcome was COOS, operative time, opioid, the milligram equivalents dosages, or total NSAID dosages as well. Morphine milligram equivalents, sorry. For total hip replacements, 23% had POR, so a smaller percentage had POR. Preoperative bladder scanning showed that the difference was 28 millimeters more urinary volume than in those who did not require catheterization, so pretty similar between the cohorts. Interestingly enough, patients with lower reported AUA scores were more likely to develop POR, which is surprising because the authors hypothesized that patients with a higher AUA score, greater than 8, would be more likely to require catheterization. So in this case, actually, lower values were actually likely to have that. So it was a surprise to the authors and a surprising finding. Similarly, there was no difference in age, sex, BMI, COOS, operative time, opioid MME doses, or total NSAID dosages as well. They had similar ratings for their bladder functions. And again, although patients who required catheterization scored lower on the AUA symptom score, the AUA score was not significantly associated with catheterizations. Females with a history of UTI had a greater rate of catheterization post-total angioarthroplasty than males who had a history of UTI. Obviously, know that women have higher rates of UTI than men. Patients who received a catheter did not have a higher rate of UTI at the time of follow-up compared to those who did not receive a catheter. So interestingly, while they're all talking about POR here, and I'm going to talk about residual volume in a second, patients who led to increased risk of catheterization because they had this increased urinary retention, that did not lead to an increased risk of UTI. So that does ask a question of whether or not you actually need this from a clinical perspective if there's no sequela from that. That said, no one likes catheters. No one wants to put a catheter in if you can help it. So that's something to think about. Looking specifically at the post-void residual volume measured on preoperative bladder scanning, it was found to be predictive of postoperative urinary retention. As this post-void residual volume increased from 50 to 200, the rate of postoperative urinary retention increased exponentially. And based on this quintile analysis, patients in the THA group, if they had a preoperative post-void residual volume of greater than 145 milliliters, they had a 95% chance of getting a catheter. If above 22 milliliters, they had a 50% chance of getting a catheter. For total knee replacement, the 95% cutoff was at 174, and the 50% cutoff was at 32. So what's the practical message? The author stated that in their institution, what they do is if you have a preoperative post-void residual volume of 30 or greater, they do tell them that they're at higher risk of the postoperative urinary retention. If postoperatively, these patients have a bladder volume of greater than 400 milliliters, the patients are catheterized once prior to discharge. Now, this is mostly for same-day discharge patients. For patients who have less than 30 milliliters of this post-void residual volume, then no additional interventions are required, even if the patient's unable to void. So if the patient's like, I can't void at their surgery, but they had that the post-void volume that's much lower, they don't have to void before going. So that is something different. Right now, you have to void before leaving the hospital from a same-day discharge patient. In this case, they say if you do scan, then potentially they can go home without having to do so. So So after implementing this protocol, the authors state that less than 1% of their patients out of 344 patients had continued urinary retention. And two of those patients had a pre-existing neurogenic bladder. So some practical tips when you're doing it from a same day discharge, if you check it, I think that the work that goes into doing so, right, is a big deal. And you'd have preoperative nurses doing so. And there was no tie to urinary retention afterwards. So that's my take. Thoughts?
Yeah. I don't know. There are a lot of things that kind of left me sort of wondering about this particular paper. The first thing is that, you know, they're saying that this is like, they're selling this as like a prospective study, right? What I would call it is a post hoc reification, reification. Okay. What reification means is that you take kind of what's the ultrastructure that already exists in your environment. It's not unique to science or to medicine. Like this happens in other disciplines like history and psychology and things like that. But you take like what's going on already, and then whatever's happening in that environment, you create a narrative around it that then makes it like the universal reality. And that's kind of what they're doing here, especially with their like, this is how we manage our protocol. And basically what they're saying is you should do it our way, right? I don't understand there's nothing different conceivably between the bladders of patients that have a total hip or the bladders of patients that have a total knee, right? So I don't understand the need to do these subset analyses of like in the total hip cohort or in the total knee cohort. It doesn't matter which cohort you're considering here. It should all basically be the same. So once you start coming up with the numbers are different and there's not a physiologic explanation for that then is a signal for this post hoc reification. They just manage those patients differently by whatever, rationale that they have or the institutional culture or whatever, sort of conventional secular practices or parochial practices are present at the Bone and Joint Institute of Hartford Hospital. That's how they manage them, right? So that is kind of a red flag for me. Like there's no need for subset analysis in this study. It should just be, these are all the total joint patients. There should be a universal cutoff because the bladder is universal in all of those patients. Agree or disagree?
So I agree. The only thing I would say is that potentially, and then it does depend on surgeon, let's say a total hip takes longer than a total knee for a surgeon or vice versa. So then the longer spinal time, that sort of thing comes into effect potentially, but the patients should be very similar. So you are correct about bladder sizes.
Right. And what they're doing before the surgery could be
that makes no difference.
Right. Like the post-void residual is going to be the post-void residual. It's not like, oh, this is the post-void residual that occurs for total knee patients versus the ones that occurs for total hip patients. And blow that up now, what they're doing at the Hartford Hospital in terms of patients that they indicate for surgery or how they manage the patients preoperatively, that could be different from the way that you do it or the way that it's done at Mass General or at Johns Hopkins. And then you start getting all of these kind of where the post hoc reification starts to kind of fall apart. And there have been a lot of studies on this. There was one that I believe was an RCT in the Journal of Arthroplasty where they were basically saying for outpatient total joints, if they don't have a very high post void residual, don't even put the catheter in.
Yeah, that was a take home there. So,
okay.
There you go. Which is interesting, even if you haven't voided. So I don't know. It's one of those things where I don't know if we would put that into our practice, but it's an interesting topic, let's say.
Avoid the post hoc reification.
And thank you for spelling that out. That was very nice of you.
Yes. All right. You already thought we were doing the Your Case is on Hold, but we actually haven't gotten there yet. So here we are. That's how meaty this issue of the journal is. Your Case is on Hold featurette, robotics and navigation do not affect the risk of periprosthetic joint infection following primary total hip arthroplasty. A propensity score matched cohort analysis by LaValva and colleagues, also with a commentary, also 30 days free. So no excuses. Get to it. Check it out. Have a read. Of course, the topic of robotics and navigation is especially hot these days. Robotics and navigation are advertised to do all sorts of things for us. Make surgery easier, lower... What? That makes breakfast? It makes breakfast while you're doing the surgery.
When?
It also vacuums, if it cleaned the ORs too in between cases, that would be...
Oh, that would be an amazing robot.
That would be especially welcome, yeah. But
that's like a Jetsons robot, you know, I would say.
Yes, yes. It's supposed to do, it, you know, make the surgeries with a lower risk of intraoperative complication, make the cuts more precise, make the biomechanics and the ergonomics of the constructs or the joint replacement more precise so that there's less risk of wear or less risk of loosening. It's supposed to do all of these things. I've never heard that robotics and navigation are supposed to change the infection risk. And the mechanism for that isn't especially well-defined as far as I'm concerned, except for the authors do make the case that these procedures take longer. And we used to have an acronym for stealth when it first came out in spine surgery. This is like first generation navigation type stuff. And stealth stood for slowly touch everything, add like 2 hours to the case.
That is super stealthy, let me tell you.
I get it. Yeah, it's so stealth they can barely see you move.
Because you are moving, actually, let's be honest.
Yeah, the premise. And this is a study where we talked about the issues with propensity score matching in the previous paper. This is one where you certainly can leverage more around the propensity score, where they have, you know, 4,000, a shade over 4,000 patients in total, with 2,000 in roughly 2,000 in the navigation and robotics, and then 5,000 plus patients versus the navigation, 2,644 in each group. So really good numbers on that front. Now, they are associated with longer operative times, but I was surprised that it's just like 3 and 11 minutes. So when I saw that, I was like, okay, so the argument for the longer time making the risk for infection isn't really there.
Correct. 3 and 11 minutes will not move the needle, which is the exact same thing. You're right.
Yeah. The
And that's the take home message.
Bacteria that are floating around and are settling on the open wound. The difference between 3 and 11 minutes, there are not that many colony forming units getting in there.
I mean, those are some fast bacteria if that were the case.
So, and surprisingly, or not surprisingly, the rates of infection after conventional total hip, 0.2 to 0.4%, were similar to computer navigated 0.4% and the robotic 0.4%. So they did a logistic regression analysis. They do say, you know, the findings are not significant, which is true. But let's delve a little bit deeper. When we look here at what the estimate, the point estimate for computer navigation, it's a 1.8, which would actually, if you just go off of the point estimate, that's an 80% increased risk of infection for computer navigation, which I believe takes longer than the robotics. But again, not in their study.
Not in their study. So, exactly right.
So you know, kind of at a loss at to where this point estimate would come from. Now, it's not significant because the 95% confidence interval includes 1.0. Now, compare that to the robotic one, right? The robotic one has an OR of 0.9. which is right around 1.0. That's like the null in a regression. Now, if you have an estimate for something that's 1.0, that means there really is no difference. People all the time will say, oh, they're the same, or there was no difference, when they're, you know, you'll have like a odds ratio of 10.5 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.3 to 150. And they'll say, oh, it was the same because the p-value is, you know, whatever, above 0.05. And people will be like, oh, it's the same, or oh, there was no difference. And it's like, well, actually, that's a big difference. You just weren't powered to detect it. And that's the case here. It seems like despite these very large numbers, you need even larger numbers to actually have a more precise determination regarding the risk that computer navigation may have on infection. But I ask you, as our chief of joint arthroplasty, knowing what we know here, whether it's negligible but real or not real at all, you know, how does this really inform decision to use navigation or robotics? There are now spine trainees coming out who they are dependent on this technology, which is really what the makers of this technology would like. They would like it for it to be where you can't do it unless you're using their technology. So if we're near that point, or we're at a tipping point in that respect, or even if we're not, and you just make a decision that you want to use robotics or navigation, I don't think it's driven by the infection risk, right?
So absolutely not. It's definitely not driven by infection risk. I think the question is whether or not people were saying, hey, look, these are the upsides of it or the downsides of it. So this would never move the needle as to which robotic system you'd use even, and if you would even use robotic. That said, if I were a hospital system purchasing a robot and said, well, if the infection risk were to go up, then that would be a problem, right? I wouldn't want to invite problems by bringing a new technology, but this would never move the needle as to whether or not you would utilize that, if that makes sense.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting work. It's a hot topic. They did the propensity score matching really good. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that they're saying and also the advertised associated risk of using these robotics or navigation in the total hip setting just don't kind of play out in the actual data.
Yep, agreed. Totally agree with your take on it. And 3 and 11 minutes don't move the needle.
Yeah, but it's good that you know they're able to do these things and not have much of a difference in terms of the operative times. On to honorable mentions. The effect of aspirin versus low molecular weight heparin thromboprophylaxis on medication satisfaction and out-of-pocket costs, a secondary analysis of a randomized controlled trial by O'Hara and colleagues. This is permanently free. This is the secondary analysis of the prevention of clots in orthopedic trauma, prevent clot trial. You don't get points when your acronym is literally the same as your study title. And the prevention, all of the letters up to the T before the I-O-N are included in the prevent clot. So you don't get points on a cool acronym. Sorry. Anyway, it's a good study. Regardless
I'm all for cool acronyms, but...
yeah. So they have over 12,000 patients with over 9,500 completing questionnaires regarding satisfaction with the chemoprophylaxis. And the use of aspirin substantially improved patient satisfaction with medication, not surprisingly, given ease of administration. And then also protected against costs greater than $25, because obviously it's a very inexpensive medication, but it did increase the odds of incurring any costs because a lot of individuals would get the prescription medications that would have been ordered for free. So you have to pay a little bit, but you don't pay more than $25. And you certainly can't beat the ease of use and the relatively innocuous side effect profile for 81 milligrams of aspirin twice daily as compared to 30 milligrams of enoxaparin. Can't beat that.
Can't beat that. I agree. I'm on board with
radio
that.
Radiocapitellar and ulnar trochlear pressures increase in a radial head fracture model, a cadaveric biomechanical analysis by France and colleagues. So they used 10 cadaveric specimens to test intraarticular pressures using sensors within the radiocapitellar and ulnar trochlear joints with the forearm in full supination when the radial head was intact after 20% was resected, 40% resected, and 100% resected. They found that the pressures in the radiocapitellar and ulnar trochlear joints were equally distributed with an intact head and after partial resection, but then radiocapitellar and ulnar trochlear pressures increased as more of the head was resected, which makes sense, significantly exceeding 100% of normal after anything above 40% of the anterolateral diameter of the radial head. Interesting cadaveric work. It's tough to sort of just give the highlight of a cadaveric biomechanical study without giving away the whole piece, but if you're into it, still check it out. Last, assessing risk of iatrogenic peroneal nerve injury in all inside lateral meniscal repair between standard versus arthroscopic MRI by Tanutit and colleagues, 30 days free. So this study looked at 28 patients and measured distances from the approach line for the use of their all inside lateral meniscal repair in relation to the peroneal nerve. And they found significantly shorter measurements on MRI scans with the knee in the standard position than in those made with the knee in the arthroscopic position. But they conclude that you can still use the standard MRI scans to determine the risk of peroneal injury at the time of arthroscopic lateral meniscal repair, although you have to kind of take into account that there may be slight overestimations. Overestimation in this setting when you're trying to avoid a nerve injury, I think that's okay. You'll go with the overestimate, because you want to be more cautious if you can. And that's where we're at for this episode. If you liked what you heard, be sure to like and subscribe, hit the notification bell, give us a 5-star rating, tell your friends, get more people listening. If you didn't like what you heard, Dr. Chen will be leading next the next episode, and maybe her dulcet tones will be more favorable, better received than my own. Either way, we're out of town and out of time at this point. We'll try to do better next time.
What a good combination. Appreciate it.
Hopefully, and your case is always good. Are ready to go, but right here, these cases are still on hold.